You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Welcome to our service of worship here at Norwood. I welcome you to our service on behalf of generations of Unitarians who worshipped here for over 169 years. As this welcome banner shows, all are welcome here. I acknowledge that the land on which our two church buildings stand is the traditional land of the Kaurna and Peramank people. We pay respect to their elders, past and present, and their spiritual relationship with the sacred land we share and which we hold in trust for future generations of Unitarians. For we are a spiritual community, one that supports you in seeking and following your own spiritual path, any path that encourages you to see more clearly, to love more abundantly, and to work towards a better world for all. And please join us after the service for coffee, tea, and a chat. So we've just read a story about wonder and certainty, the wonder of a young girl about what her toy boat can do, how far it might sail. And of course, there were difficulties in that journey, some stumbling, but in the end, triumphant. In our daily decision-making, we, of course, search for certainty. It makes life more predictable. We need to know when it's safe to sail our boat, or when it's safe to cross a road, or when we should give way to another driver at a roundabout, and when it's appropriate to greet someone with a smile, a handshake, or even a hug. Some things, like what we're to believe about life and death, whether there is a spiritual life after death, are much more complex. And it may take a whole lifetime for us to decide what our ideas are about God and nature. A journey at its best, an adventure that we may never really get to complete. A spiritual journey, mine, yours. It's foolish to say that we all have the answers, yet so many people seem to believe that they do have all the answers. There are some people who, even from a very early age, are quite certain about such complex matters. They may think they know all the answers already, or simply believe what other people tell them, without ever questioning. Or they believe what they read in books or see in films. They would say there's a satisfaction, if not a joy, to be had in certainty, especially if they're certain that the outcome will be joyful or in some way blissful. In their minds, they've made their journey. They're certain their destination will be a happy place. They're waiting. They stop growing, stop exploring. They've arrived. Or have they? I'm less certain about many such spiritual matters. I'm still making the journey, still wondering. Like the girl in the story, there's a joy to be had in wondering, in discovering things about yourself, what you can do, what you can't do. It's why we need each other, of course. developing ideas and feelings about spirituality, about divinity, about the nature of God, about God and nature, about nature. Like this little native flower that I'm still searching for at Shady Grove. I can spot the plant, but it's yet to flower. It'll flower for itself in its own time, not to please me. Now it's time for a sing. And our first hymn is A Prayer for Children. And the peace, hope and renewal that sleep might bring to a child, even in the difficult times. I think of the children in Ukraine. It's an old Unitarian hymn. You'll remember the tune, I hope. Number 53, I don't think we've sung it for a few years in our green hymn book. It'll be on the screen. It's lifted from a longer poem, Lines Written in Kensington Gardens, in London that is, by the English poet Matthew Arnold. Amidst the hustle and turmoil of a city, there is peace to be found. It may just descend quietly, gently, unheralded, like dewfall on cold grass. The preceding lines of the longer poem are, "The night comes down upon the grass. The child sleeps warmly in his bed." Brendan will play it through once just to refamiliarise you with the tune, and the words are on the screen. Today's reading is by Grant Shillabeer.
Today's reading is titled Da Vinci's Sfumato Principle, Embracing Uncertainty with Ease, from an article by Chris Brady, writing in High Existence in 2020 at the height of the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. Originally a painting technique popularized by Leonardo da Vinci, sfumato is foremost a subtle way to blend colors so that they melt into each other, without clear transitions, lines, or edges. Derived from the Italian word fumo, for smoke, sfumato translates as smoked, going up in smoke, or turned to mist. It could also mean soft, vague, or blurred. The sfumato principle is a willingness to embrace ambiguity, paradox, and uncertainty. Sfumato is said to be one of Da Vinci's most unique qualities as an artist, a tolerance for uncertainty found only in great geniuses like Leonardo. Sfumato encourages innovation and hastens change. Ambiguity increases, certainty decreases. Poise in the face of paradox is a key not only to effective living, but to sanity in a rapidly changing world. As the world continues to connect globally, and when various cultural perspectives come into greater contact with one another, disagreements are bound to happen. A tolerance for uncertainty can help diverse people coexist with one another. A tolerance for uncertainty will also help shield us from a need to know the answer, while opening us to consider multiple perspectives other than our own. It can help us build immunity against certain religions, cults, and conspiracy theories trying to preach their one and only truth. It avoids war. It also prevents us from taking ourselves too seriously. Tolerance for uncertainty can help make us more empathetic, Uncertainty also encourages us to seek and to wonder. We can only wonder at things we don't fully understand, where we are still searching for meaning and understanding. It can also protect us from giving in to the ideas imposed by tyrants and protect us from the certainties and simplicities of fundamentalism. Certainty closes our minds, wonder opens them again.
Thank you, Grant. So today I want to talk about what brought me to Unitarianism and the universalism it tends to lead towards, to the limited extent that I can really understand the complexities of religions, creeds, beliefs, and acceptance of the difference that goes with it. I'm sort of fairly blinkered. Some people may have travelled more widely and experienced and lived other religious traditions. I've been brought up in a fairly Christian background. But I've learnt sfumato, keeping an open, receptive, and accepting mind on spiritual issues, especially. Wondering still, not feeling threatened by difference, by diversity. Fundamentalists would say, lacking commitment, and be damned. I grew up at Glendore. Who knows where Glendore is? Yeah, near Black Forest, at a time in the late 1940s when houses were springing up like mushrooms amongst the cow paddocks. Ours sprang up in the late 40s during the austerity era. I'd spent my first 5 years of life living on the grounds of St. Peter's College, where my grandfather was the caretaker. But there came a time when the family had to move out of this very large house, and we moved to Glendore. So the austerity era meant that building supplies were very short. Houses had to be fairly Spartan. But along came four boys, and Dad and my grandpa had to build on to accommodate us. Grandpa was a builder, happened to be a former captain of Port Adelaide Football Club, in fact. And Dad played for Port Adelaide too, and I can remember the joys of going along to football matches and watching him play on a Saturday afternoon as a very young child. I was an accidental Presbyterian. Accidental because Black Forest Church just happened to be our closest, adjacent to the Glendore Oval and tennis courts, where I played a lot of my sport. It was a small community of Anglo-Australians, quite a few with Scottish ancestry. I had none that I knew of, a nucleus of old Scots with bagpipes brought out on great days, like St. Andrew's Day. As well, there were a group of Dutch recently arrived after the war, and so we became a focus. They were looking for something vaguely Calvinistic, and John Knox, the Presbyterian forefather, was close enough to them. And so we had the joy of a Dutch community intermingled with people from a Scottish background. And so we became familiar with Dutch cooking, like oily bowls, which if you've ever had are a wonder to behold, not good for the waistline, but that wasn't a matter for us kids. It was a warm and embracing community, a community of love and faith. The Bible was carried in by an elder, reverently, at the beginning of every service, as the infallible word of God. There was, with some members, great certainty in that assumption. And at that stage of my childhood, I had no reason to question it. The church fostered my love of singing. I grew up there amongst lots of other young people. Our Sunday school anniversaries needed a four-tier platform. Can you imagine it in that little church hall? That was our church for most of the time. 60-odd kids in all at its peak. And we were the advance guard of the baby boomers who were still to come along. I even taught Sunday school there. And to shoot forward half a dozen years, in the summer holidays of early 1970, and now newly married, Faye and I left the Black Forest Church and moved to McGill, near where I taught, the Nord High School as it was then, and Faye at McGill Primary School. We were not to escape the tentacles of the Presbyterian Church, however, because we were soon tracked down by the Reverend Bert Scrimger, the minister at Tusmore Presby Church, adjacent to Tusmore Park, and he happened to have a few kids at the school, and of course, who was to teach them? Me. In these more materialistic and affluent times, however, churches, especially liberal ones, were contracting in size, as my old childhood church, Black Forest Presby, did. It was sold, became a land agent's office, later to be demolished and replaced by a company selling sheds and gazebos. But it's a legacy that lives on in me and others. At Tusmore Presby, however, we soon found ourselves back in the company of many of our old Dutch friends. And there were Scots there too. More oily bowls, and on St. Andrew's Day, haggis and some covert whiskey, double malt. However, we found ourselves torn between the lure of a promotion as principal at Yorktown Area School, but due to the illness of Faye's mum and my dad, they both needed our support, and the old Californian bungalow that we'd just bought, imagine that, starting off married life with a house, your own, to move into. I am somewhat upset by the struggles young people face nowadays. So with those forces into playing, I wisely declined the appointment, and we both hunkered down to support our parents through their illnesses for the next 2 years, and they died within 2 days of each other. Whilst recognising the inherent wisdoms within all religions, I, like so many others of all religious persuasions, have always lived with a level of cognitive dissonance, where science conflicted with the dogma that was being held up as gospel truth by the faithful, and science offered better answers. My closest boyhood friends were brothers, Ian and Ross Broughton. Both died in their mid-20s. Of the galloping Duchenne's form of muscular dystrophy, but not before Ian had managed to establish the Broughton Art Society. In those days it was called the Art Society for the Handicapped. Nowadays we shy away from that term handicap, simply due to the recognition that we are all handicapped in one way or another. It's why we need each other. Two brilliant boys who had lots of promise and yet cut off in their prime. In their mid-20s, they died. And, of course, the death of our two parents contributed to the realisation that bad things do happen to good people. In Ian Ross's case, it's their genes. It's passed on from their mother. In my dad's case, I only needed to go back through the family tree to find a bitter legacy of brain tumours every generation. But it's not punishment from an all-powerful God. The fundamentalist Christian notion of a loving but omnipotent, all-powerful God was on shaky ground indeed. This dissonance was triggered by my interest in astronomy as a 12-year-old. As a 14-year-old with my head in the stars, before I'd discovered girls, I spent sort of several weeks of my 56-57 summer holidays grinding and polishing a mirror for a 7-inch Newtonian reflecting telescope. I still have it, not the telescope, the mirror, usable. The telescope never quite finished. A tube there in the shed, ready to go, but never quite finished, perhaps one day. My reading of Sky and Telescope and books by Fred Hoyle and Bart J. Bock showed me that the universe was infinitely vaster than the human-scaled story of creation. And then astronomy and the Hubble and Webb telescopes have since expanded the size of the universe significantly since even then. We can now see what we claim to be the edge and centre of the universe, or can we? My hunch is it's really infinite. So how might we resolve this cognitive dissonance between faith, belief and science? And how did I resolve mine, or do I attempt to resolve it now? It's an ongoing process. We all resolve cognitive dissonance in three main ways. We can live with it, which is what most people probably do, accept that they don't know everything, but believe what they choose to. or beliefs may become even more deeply entrenched and reinforced, despite all the evidence to the contrary. It's what happened in the Feistinger study of the doomsday cult when prophecy fails. I talked about that previously. Or it could be a selective or total rejection of some or all of those beliefs. And I guess mine was the latter, a selective rejection. I still accept many of the wisdoms in Christianity, many of them shared in one form or another with many other mainstream religions. It's what underpins much of civil society. It's how we've evolved into complex urban conurbations of people that more or less get on. But as Bishop Spong observes, there's no external, objective, revealed standard governing our ethical behaviour for all time, especially as we face environmental limitations to growth. Subdue the earth and all its creatures is now no longer tenable. I helped establish studies in religion within the secular state school system, where I was very heavily involved in curriculum. Now, this is a trade-off needed to get rid of religious instruction. RI allowed well-meaning Christian, mostly lay folk, outside the school to conduct Bible lessons, usually on a Wednesday in my experience. It lasted as long as it did because it gave teachers an extra lesson of non-contact time. They could get some marking done. RI remains in most other states, probably for that reason. In South Australia, it was thought to be failing, and RI classes were being counterproductive, with a few exceptions. I can always remember that man there on the right, Arthur Jackson. Anybody come across Arthur Jackson? Amazing man. He succeeded in taming an unruly RI class that I was fortunate enough to attend as a Year 11 student at Unley High School. Arthur had the presence of a Shakespearean actor. Instead of focusing on the dogma, all the unbelievable bits, Arthur focused on the drama inherent in the Old and New Testament stories and the wisdoms they revealed. Studies in religion gave rise to a series of books, not those. I looked through my bookcase, I couldn't find the old books. They gave equal exposure to the major religions of the world. However, I can remember coming in for some strong criticism by mainstream Christians. They thought that I was relegating Christianity to a phenomenon amongst all the other phenomena that were religions. It was something less than the one true faith that they believed in. However, under studies of religion, my classes visited places of worship as opportunities arose, such as the Adelaide Synagogue for a bar mitzvah. In our case, one of the boys of the class was about to be a bar mitzvah boy, so we all went along to celebrate that great day for him, or bar mitzvah for girls. Or visiting a variety of Orthodox and other denominational Christian churches, and of course the old Adelaide Mosque that you can see here. And well ahead of its time, we made contact with the local Kaurna elders who spoke to our classes about Aboriginal wisdoms, about country, about the seasons, and about the dream time. We had a little bit of bushland on our school grounds, and that's where we conducted those lessons. So what drew me to Unitarianism? Well, since my early 20s, I've always been interested in theology and the God debate. I've explored the theologians like Søren Kierkegaard and Marcus Borg and John Shelby Spong, who were articulating what seemed to me to be a more believable Jesus, a radical but remarkable Jewish teacher. In claiming to be the Messiah, Jesus became, for his fellow Jews, the ultimate blasphemer, and was crucified. That Jesus was mortal, however, gave me great hope. You may remember how Arius, the Unitarian Alexandrian scholar, spoke out against the Trinitarian view of Athanasius and Saint Alexander, all from Alexandria at the time. Arius questioned Jesus as the son bit of God the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost at the First Council of Nicaea. That was in 325 AD. This gave rise to the Nicene Creed that my generation were taught. We had to learn it in RI lessons. The Trinitarians won the debate, and the blasphemer Arius was banished to the Balkans with two of his followers. Only three dissented. The dogma of the Trinity gave a Trinitarian church much greater power than a Unitarian church. If we're good, an eternal reward awaits in the arms of a resurrected Christ, one who will come again as the Messiah to save and raise up all the faithful, whether they're dead or alive. Our Unitarian rejection of the doctrine of the Trinity might be one of the reasons why we don't have all that many people sitting here today. Although most Trinitarian churches, it's probably fair to observe, most Trinitarian churches are also in rapid decline and consolidating as more people resolve their dissonance. Another significant influence in my life was from my Presbyterian days, Professor William Barclay. Hands up if you've read Barclay. He was wonderful. Professor of Theology at Glasgow University for many years. You might have heard his series of lectures on the BBC that were broadcast here. In going back to the ancient Greek and Aramaic that Jesus spoke, Barclay would bring the true meaning of each beatitude to life. We once had these videotapes in our library. To give the third beatitude as an example, blessed are the meek, the King James Version says. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. As Jesus would have really taught, it means meek is not really meek, but those who have great reserves of strength and who will use this strength proportionately and wisely. So Barclay concludes, what it really means is blessed are those with strength in their gentleness. How far do we get the Christian message wrong because of the King James Version? I was also attracted to the 12 theses of the American Episcopalian Bishop of Newark, John Shelby Spong, another blasphemer who I've talked on soon after he died here and at Shady Grove. Whenever John Spong came to Adelaide, I went to hear him, as I know some of you did. John Spong said that we need a new way to speak of God. Jesus as Messiah, the one who will raise us all up, is bankrupt. The story of a perfect and finished creation is post-Darwinian nonsense. And the rejection of the virgin birth makes Christ's divinity impossible, and so on. The cross, as Jesus' sacrifice for our sins and the sins of the world, is a barbarian idea based on primitive concepts of God. It was soon after I retired that I accidentally discovered Unitarianism and the universalism that it seemed to lead towards. I had almost 20 years earlier set up a printery at Gartfield Church, just down the road. It was staffed by recently retired public servants, all who were fascinated by machines and wanted to do some printing. So when I retired, I thought I'd go and join them, having set it up. So I'd catch the bus down the parade, walk down past this church to Gartrell. And there on the 6-foot-high wall was a notice board, Jane's notice board. I always connected with Jane. And I would read the notices and I thought, well, there's a whole lot of stuff there. And I'd see that science and religion could coexist amicably, and it beckoned me in. So one day, it was Easter, I thought I'd go to an Easter service here, and I walked down, and in expectation of some music, the place was deserted. This is strange, but there were two people inside, two Peters, I believe, Peter Godfrey and our Peter, and Peter Godfrey beckoned me in, and we had a long talk. That was what drew me into this particular church. As mentioned earlier, Spong held that new standards were needed, such as those promoted within our seven principles. And those beliefs are still evolving, as they must. Spong thought that prayers of intercession for a God to intercede on our behalf was nonsense, without purposeful action. Shades of Soren Kierkegaard. The function of prayer is not to influence God, but to change the nature of the one who prays. and our human hope for life after death, Spong believed, must be separated from reward, punishment, and guilt. Very recently, I read in the Smithsonian, groundbreaking physiological studies of brain scans accidentally coinciding with a patient's death. They were doing a brain scan, the patient died, and it showed how a clinically brain-dead person has a huge burst of brain cell activity at the moment of death. Scientists ponder whether it's a transitory revisiting of one's life in the instant before death. Hopefully all the good bits, that might be the heaven. The Genesis version of creation sees us as the very pinnacle of his creation, created by God in his image, but it's really because we've created God in our image. He is an African Jesus and a Chinese Jesus. In America, he used to be shown as blonde and blue-eyed. As a Galilean man, Jesus was quite the opposite. He'd have been chucked off the buses in the Bible Belt of 1960s USA. And at other times, or in other religions, non-Christian traditions, it was a multitude of gods, male and female, gods to explain stuff when our science couldn't. Gods for all occasions, for whom we might channel our joys, fears, hopes, and dreams. I wonder, would God exist without us Homo sapiens? To formulate the idea of God, and in the absence of better explanations, to give this chaotic world some order and meaning. Where does this leave me at this stage of my life now as a Unitarian? I'm still conflicted, dissonant. I'm still awed by grand cathedrals and great religious art and music. I've rethought and revised my worldview and the sense of entitlement that goes with it. It's given us the license to subdue the earth and all the creatures, to nature's loss and to our short-term gain, and now to our great peril, it seems. But I also see in it the power of human creativity, imagination, genius, inspired by their God, perhaps, but also with their eyes firmly fixed on establishing and benchmarking their reputations amongst their peers for posterity. As a chorister for much of my life, I've helped to perform some of this amazing religious music. I rejoice in it. It gives me hope in human creativity and genius. A Catholic Mozart, his Requiem and lots of masses, and of course the Lutherans, Bach and Handel, the latter becoming an Anglican. Along with that great teacher, Jeshua, who inspired them all, it's part of my heritage. It's helped to shape me and my beliefs. Nowadays, I see my truths increasingly in the divinity and complexity of nature and its laws, including human nature. With disasters, I've come to recognize that nature is neutral. I'm a pantheist whose beliefs are primarily shaped by science and human wisdom. A scientific pantheist, I guess. Nature, both God and the devil, beauty and its terror, heaven and hell, to be found in its harmony and chaos, not in a loving, vengeful, and omnipotent God. Much of the chaos of the world is our own doing, and perhaps our eventual undoing. We build our heavens and our hills here. But we need the chaos to see the order, don't we? We also need the storm to feel the calm. And let's not forget that it's out of the chaos of crisis, of calamity, that we humans do much of our learning and perhaps begin to put right what we had wrong. But I also see the face of God, the living presence of God, in the kindnesses, self-sacrifice and love of loving others, many of them good Christian folk still, who I know and love. I see them here, I see them there, who go on believing, who go on loving unconditionally, as did their Lord and Saviour, Jesus, for we refine our love out of that mixed bag of emotions wherein may lurk hate. Hate expressed by others, perhaps even by us, or perhaps it's that temptation to hate. And to quote Nicholas and Nicolette Sauder from that lovely poem that Mary sent out to us, We must be the ones to see that the rose needs the thorn, to tend the tender things, to walk or run into rain-swept days as much as into sunny ones, and to speak out for those who have no voice. May it be so. We'll have a hymn. Our final hymn is hymn number 3, and you'll all know this one, I think, won't need any explanation. Remain standing. Let's take time to share. Try hard to live our lives by our shared Unitarian wisdoms. They're still evolving, as are all wisdoms, and so they should, for the end of growth is marked by atrophy and decay. These wisdoms have been born out of our past mistakes, regrets, hopes for something better, and the willpower to change. Let's live our wisdoms proactively. We will, at the very least, have replaced our regrets with hope. Hope leads to action, and as hope is infectious, so it will spread.
We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.